Hey, what's up, everyone? How are you? I am Ben Kissel with Henry Zebrowski.
Yes, it is me.
Thank you all so much for giving to our Patreon. Without you, none of this is possible, and we just appreciate you so much. Hail yourselves. And we are honored right now to have with us the creator, the founder of the Morbid Anatomy Museum, Joanna Ebenstein, is with us. Thank you so much for being with us, Joanna.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me. And just one quick correction to make. I am the co-founder of the Morbid Anatomy Museum. Tracy Hurley Martin is the other co-founder, so she deserves equal props for that, to make sure her name is out there as well.
Well, there it is. And that is the record for the quickest mistake that I've made so far. I mean, it happened in the first 30 seconds.
Don't worry.
Wow.
You're not the first, and at least I had a chance to correct it. Usually it gets printed in the New York Times, and then it's a deal.
Joanna, can I open with a question here that's going to be a little like, it's going to be a little more like morning drive time radio kind of question. Do you drive a hearse covered in bones, or do you have like a car, and do you take the train and stuff like that?
I'm a normal person who takes the train. I'm abnormal in the sense that I drive nothing. I have no driver's license. And everyone who's been intimately involved with Morbid Anatomy has also not had a driver's license.
Really?
So you have to take this shit on the train? You have to take all the bats and the skulls on the G train?
Have actually carried a human skeleton on the train. We have that as a donation. Our first year that we were open, a friend of mine's uncle whispered to me at a party that he had a donation if I was interested. And I went up to very, very northern Manhattan. He gave me a human skeleton in a sack. And it was disarticulated, and I carried it home on the subway. So yes, I have carried a human skeleton.
That's amazing. So it's basically like you're dealing with a series of people who may or may not be H.H. Holmes. Is that right?
Well, you know, this guy, yeah, well, the short answer, yes, you're probably correct. But this guy was a doctor, and it was a medical skeleton, but his wife didn't like it anymore. So I get a lot of things. Yeah, we get a lot of donations from people whose wives don't like things they have. That's pretty common.
That's so, Joanna, I have to ask. So you have all of this crazy stuff there. A lot of it is like, how the heck did you get all of it? And what was one of the creepier things that you've gotten? But what's the process of actually just like attaining these things that are, you know, extremely unique?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been doing Morbid Anatomy since 2007, and it started as a blog. And from the very beginning, people just started to email me with, again, things they didn't want in their house anymore, things their wife didn't want, things that they just wanted to share with the public. So as soon as I had a mailing address, things would just come in the mail. So I received a lot of warning photos of like coffins. So I don't know how much you guys know, but in the 19th century, people would take photographs of the deceased. They're called postmortem photographs. And it was a way of just memorializing the dead at a time when photography was very expensive and pretty rare. So there's a ton of them lying around. They're very collectible now. And people, I think three or four of those came our way from anonymous donors just saying, hey, we thought, you know, we had this in the house. We'd like it to be seen by more people. I also got a pair of emu feet, kind of legs up from the knee down. For, again, a guy whose wife didn't want them. They just came in a box unannounced one day. I got a human skull in the mail. So I guess that's a very long way of saying there's a lot of donations. And I think people... Yeah. You'd be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't, because of the topic of your podcast. You're right. Capitalizing on this as well. There's a lot of people who are really interested in this, and as soon as I started Morbid Anatomy, you know, I never intended it to be anything but a research tool for myself, but there were so many people out there who I think felt alienated from the culture at large because they love this stuff, that they were just so excited to be a part of it.
Has there ever been something you received where you're like, maybe we should contact law enforcement? Like what, like, is there ever a follow-up being like, how did you attain this human skull?
The human skull we got, we never put on display because I felt it had like spider webs with a sun bleach. And it looked like it probably came from a grave, and we didn't call law enforcement for what we attempted to, but we didn't do anything with it. We didn't feel comfortable with that. I think the most frightening thing we received, we were getting letters for a while from a guy in prison, like a Trump supporter in prison who wanted $10,000. That was probably the most, the thing that probably frightened us the most. We got some weird letters.
Yeah.
What I loved about the Morbid Anatomy Museum, because I had come to the Gowanus location several times.
You did, great.
Yes, and it was. I mean, obviously, it's awesome, and I will miss that. I miss that location. I'm glad that you guys at least can get around a little bit exhibition style, and so people can see some of the wares that you guys are peddling, which are fascinating. But what I loved about the museum is that it shows how the specifically, like, in America, like, we've gone through, like, many dark stripes of obsession with death and the occult. And it's like, for now, it's just like, you know, because I remember because you did the whole special on magic and stage magic and all that kind of stuff. Like, what is your personal favorite occult period in America?
I guess for me, I'm interested in the 19th and early 20th century. That's my area of interest in general. And I'm interested, I think there's this really interesting mix of things at that time where people are interested in the, let's say, the unseen world, the invisible world. But science has already proven so many things or shown us so many things that we had no idea about. So, you know, I always think when Lister discovered germ theory, you know, when he looked under the microscope and saw that water was writhing with all of these microscopic creatures. You think of how utterly monstrous and frightening and bizarre that must have been, right? There's these things that we had no idea existed that we take for granted, say, or the X-ray, where something you can see into the body in a way that no one had ever imagined. And I'm really fascinated with the era in the 19th and early 20th century of spiritualism, when people were basically trying to apply the same scientific principles toward seeing ghosts and photographing ghosts and visiting with the souls of the dead. So we've done, and we went to the magic show, so you saw that's one of the main themes that we were interested in, is that Thurston, who was the main magician we were focusing on, was really playing with that blurry edge at that time when he was famous, which was the late 19th, early 20th century, of like, is it real? Is it not real? Is it science? Is it illusion? Is it magic? Or is it magic, like sorcery, you know? And I'm very, very interested in how, the more we change, the more we stay the same. You know, like our interest in ghosts hasn't gone away. It just kind of gets retranslated to this this more scientific, quote unquote, way of looking at it.
Yeah, just to kind of piggyback a little bit on Henry's question, when it comes to the conversation surrounding death, obviously we have those on a regular basis, but what do you think is, as an expert on it, what do you think is missing when we discuss death, when we discuss, what that process is like?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The way I see it, and correct me, I mean, you guys are doing a lot of work in this area, so I'd be interested to know if you disagree, but I feel like the way that we talk about death now is mostly kind of pop culture and subcultural, like horror films and, the kind of basement lectures we were doing at Morbid Anatomy, but there's very little kind of, for lack of a better word, like sophisticated, above board conversation that has to do with kind of art and philosophy and literature. You know, like people, I feel like there's a lack of, I hate to say this word, but dignified discourse around death. So there's a lot of like, dude, that's cool, or that's awesome, or oh, fuck, that's crazy. But there's very little serious conversation about it. And to me, when I look, my background is history. So looking at the past and looking at art history, you know, what I find really, really striking is, so far as I've ever seen, there is no other time or place that has banished this kind of sober, serious discourse and art production around death in the way that we have. So yes, we do talk about it, but it's like an embarrassed aside, or it's icky and weird. Right. And the past didn't see it that way. And, you know, like what I always try to say to people is, if you think about the 19th century, you know, they say up to 3 out of 5 children die before reaching adulthood. You know, people butchered their own animals. You know, we had horses, so there was death all around us. This idea that we have today that death is something exotic that happens off stage, that's weird, you know, didn't ever exist in all of human history so far as I can see. You know, we didn't have hospitals to send the dying to, and we laid out the dead in the parlor, in the home parlor, you know. So there's this idea that I think there's this, because death has gone away from our daily visible life, you know, you go to the market and you see meat as a spread object in a styrofoam container, you know. Death doesn't exist to us anymore in the same way. So it can be weird, but it never could be weird before. It was just part of everyday life.
That's interesting.
There's a thinker named Ram Dass that has been doing a lot of like the idea of accepting death. Like, he did a whole series of he's essentially like a guru type that was for a while, like he basically used his descent into cancer to talk about making peace with death. It's very interesting. It's very like, I was talking about it with my therapist, because obviously I'm hyper afraid of death, especially because of our show. It's like, because of the fascination, how much research we have to do into the show, I think about my own death quite a bit. And Ram Dass was like the idea of like taking fear out of it. But I also think a part of the way our capitalist system works is that they count on the fear of death to drive sales. Is that a part of what's what's really nice about being afraid to die all the time is that, like, sometimes just, like, buying a pair of shoes, like, makes you feel much better about it. Like, you just, you can focus on the material. And so now it's the idea of this, the separating of the two are really important. They want to make sure that you don't think about it. Because I was going to ask you about that, all of the morning pictures. They're so interesting because it used to be an everyday occurrence to have the dead in your home. They used to build, because what was it, coffin corners is what they used to call?
Yeah, coffin corners. Or even, I don't know if you know this, but, you know, that we have what's called the living room in our home. And before it was the living room, it was called the parlor, and it was where the dead were laid out. And in 1906, or you can read this article in Ladies' Home Journal or Godey's Lady Book, I forget which, where basically you have a writer saying, hey, let's not call the parlor anymore. Let's call it the living room, the room for the living, you know? There's a real conscious shift and change that happens, right? Everything you say is totally true. And, I, you know, what I've always tried to do through Morbid Anatomy, through the blog, through the events we do, through our exhibitions, without a lot of text, just showing people all of these objects from the past, so they start to think critically about our own attitudes about death.
Right.
And I think you often hear people say, like, oh, the Victorians were death obsessed, or, you know, the Edwardians were death obsessed. And I think, well, no. If you want to look at it that way, then all of human history was death obsessed, and we're the ones who are normal, you know? I don't think so. Like, death is something that is a real part of human, you know, of human life, and to pretend otherwise, you know, just seems kind of pathological.
Yeah, I don't really understand why I'm a fucking maniac just because I want my Uncle Kevin's body in my living room for several days. Like, I want us all to look at
him. Times have changed, Henry. Times have changed.
It'd be kind of fun to, like, you could put him in different costumes. You could play with his hands and his legs and weekends Bernie with him, like, all day. Like, but no one wants to do that anymore. No one's fun.
You know, you make fun of it, but there are people who have said that, you know, I've never done this myself, but that when they have kept the body overnight in the home, they kind of use that as a way to process the death in a way that was very, very useful to them.
Yeah.
So there's something very strange, and maybe going back to what you were saying about capitalism, you know, this capitalistic desire, like, keep moving, keep spending, keep doing, you know, like, anything that takes you out of day-to-day life is not acceptable and pathological, but this is never the case before. You know, there's something really strange to me about a culture that pathologizes mourning the loss of something that's meaningful. You know what I mean?
They don't want us lost in thought. They don't want us lost in thought. And I think a lot of, because they were talking about with the breakdown of, they were talking about the way that they developed Twitter and Facebook and the technology, the way it's done to sort of spike your endorphins with, like, making you crave the interaction every single day and essentially the social points that you get and how it's now leading towards, like, I forget what the term is, but, like, when you stop your day-to-day life to look at your phone every 5 to 10 minutes in order to update yourself on how much everybody loves you, it's like destroying your ability to comprehensively think or hate you, which is what we're discovering.
And of course, it also equates things like you know, something very significant like nuclear war with something as ridiculous as an NBA finals and puts those on the same level of significance, which is totally insane. But I want to go back just a little bit to what Henry and you were discussing.
Yeah.
When it comes to our disconnection with death, we live in this society where we have these mass shootings happening on a regular basis. We are surrounded by death in cinema, on television, but it seems like we don't have any understanding of what it actually means to pass on and how devastating that is for people. Do you think that is because we no longer really see what death was? Like, we never stare it in the eyes like we used to. We just sort of have this glamorized vision of it. If you go back and listen to what Nicholas Cruz was talking about, the Parkland shooter, talking about how he's going to be the next big school shooter of 2018. He's going to be on the cover of the magazines like Charnov was, or even Charles Manson on the Rolling Stone. Do you think that plays into what's happening right now, the recent phenomenon of just spree killing?
It's interesting. I mean, I think, you know what, I think a lot about the difference between now and all of human history beyond how we deal with death is also mythology or religion or some meaning-making system that makes sense of death. You know what I mean? So I feel like one of the problems we have right now as a culture, as a society, is that the only people defining the meaning of death and death in our lives are doctors and scientists, you know, and before that it was mostly Christianity in our country, but in other, you know, other cultures, different religions or mythology, and death was seen as a rite of passage to another stage of existence. Mm. You know, I think always, like, I don't think there's a culture that didn't believe in an afterlife in some way, shape, or form. And this idea that we have today is that bodily death is the end, capital, you know? It's like, that's it. It's when consciousness stops and it's over. There are many, many, many other ways that people have looked at this over time. So I think part of why people are shooting fools is also because we live a life that's very meaningless now. And death, the lack of talking about death is part of it and not the entire thing. I think people, it's like the onus is on us to find a meaningful life. And, you know, we can criticize religion as much as we want. I would not want to be a woman under Christianity, you know, in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. However, it did at least provide a frame for understanding these rites of passage in life that are difficult,
right.
You know, that include mm-hmm. sickness and death. So I feel like right now, part of the reason that we're having this conversation that people are intrigued, are interested, is that I think we're all, as a culture, trying to figure out, like, how do we make sense of life? And how mm-hmm. do we, you know, I always felt like one of the things about Morbid Anatomy, we did, as you know, we did events almost every night of the week, and we did events on all sorts of things. But some of the most popular things, going back to one of your earlier questions, was kind of the occult and magic. And when I thought about this, I thought, well, what is it? Like, why is it so popular with young people? You know, and it was mostly people in their 30s, 20s and 30s. These were sold-out events. People were super interested. And I think kind of what we were providing through our discussion of death and, I would say, alternative ways of knowing the world, you know, kind of things that people once believed that we no longer believe. They were trying to kind of find their own meaning system, kind of like magpies. You know, mm-hmm. this is what I feel like I'm doing. Like, you know, maybe there's something interesting there. Maybe we threw the baby out with the bathwater. Maybe I can't accept all of this, but maybe there's something of value that can help me create my own patchwork belief system, you know, right. that helps me make sense of the world and make sense of things like, you know, getting bullied at school or, you know, like these connections to something larger than just the everyday. And I think there's right. something, you know, and I think you guys must think about this during the podcast, right? Like, why are podcasts so popular right now? Because people want to hear stories. That's how we make sense of the world, you know? It's that it's so soothing to us. It's so intrinsic to who we are. But now our stories all come from pop culture. They come from film. They come from television. And those people aren't as responsible in crafting meaningful yep. stories that give people value, a sense of value, and more than that, like a framework that allows them to go through the very difficult transitions we all will go through. The death yep. of loved ones, the loss of partners, mm-hmm. you know, all of these things that are being bullied in school that then become crises that can't be dealt with. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
I believe that the occult is a really good almost version of, I would say almost a disposable spirituality. There is something about it because you can adopt it as a cap, like as a person who studied ritual magic and chaos magic, a part of what the tenets of it is that you allow the things that interest you that fit certain situations, you can look at it through the lens of like, I'm going to look at this through a Judeo-Christian lens. I'm going to look at this through a Hinduism lens. I'm going to look at this through like Al Sutra. I'm going to look at through all these different things. And it allows you to, in a way, number one, gain empathy for other people's points of view, understand that. And then it's also the cobbling together of your own personal meaning towards your life. And it's like, and I don't think you need religion to do that, but I think that there's a lot of people that are afraid of the work that it takes to put together an intrinsic meaning to your life.
Or maybe don't even understand that they have to do that. You know, like I feel right. so lucky to have been brought up in California and lived in New York where I'm surrounded by smart people who are really engaged and asking lots of questions. But, you know, I've lived in other places. I spent a month in Alabama, you know, like I know that this is not how the world is for everybody all the time. And it's not, unless you're lucky enough to be born in a cool urban center or have, for me, I also had European grandparents. And I consider that such an influence on how I developed. Like if you're just born into American culture and you don't have access to anything beyond, you know, your community, I guess that's changed now because people on the internet, but still there's so much there. How do you know how to find the good stuff? You know, you don't have a cool older friend or an older sister. You know, and you're reading People magazine, like the world that America is offering to us on the silver platter is mm-hmm. so shallow.
Well, it's just so it's so disposable in every single possible way, right? Just everything is plastic furniture from Walmart. Everything, you know, it's going to break in 6 months, but you enjoy the process of repurchasing it, I guess.
Yes, but even more than that, like, I think we're having this conversation right after the suicides of Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade, right? And I've also been thinking a lot about this. You know, I was the head of the Morbid and Ebony Museum, and it did not make me a celebrity, but it changed how I was treated, you know. And in a way, I remember thinking at the height of the museum was a wonderful thing, and I was so proud to be able to make a thing that affected people, and I felt it was a great responsibility, and I took it very seriously. But it made my personal life much harder. It was not a pleasant. It didn't make my life richer. And I kept thinking, well, my culture has always told me in many ways that this is what I'm supposed to do, you know? You're supposed to climb higher and higher until you're, you know, Morbid and Ebony was some stupid block, you know? It should never have become a museum, a standalone museum in New York City, but it did.
You're talking to the two of the same people that were surprised by the same exact thing, where it was like the two right. of us just, the three of us got together to make Last Podcast on the Left. It was simply out of joy and simply out of the wanting to do something about this. For me, I wanted to become an expert in the occult and true crime. I wanted to be a real Ghostbuster. That was like my whole drive. But then there's a saddle, right? Then it comes down to, it's like, all right, well, now I have a responsibility to my patrons and all this kind of, there's a pressure to it, which is like, you could see what happened with somebody like Anthony Bourdain, who's like, the whole world is like, you're the coolest motherfucker on the planet.
And so this is what I'm thinking about with America, is like, America's telling us, it's offering this value system that we're all chasing to some degree because it's our culture. And we're like, okay, that's what I should do. And then you get there, right? You guys have gotten there. Then you get there and you're like, oh, wait a second, you know, this has poisoned my personal relationship. I keep thinking of like the King Midas myth, right? Where like everything he touches turns to gold, and gold is great. But I think once you become something that signifies something to other people, you know, in Anthony Bourdain, how many people could treat him like a normal human at the point he was in his celebrity? I think there's something so alienating about that. And I see people, I don't know, that's just one example of, I think, what America is offering that is not just cheap and tawdry, but also psychologically super damaging and destructive to all but the very, very strongest. You know, yeah. So I think there's something about our culture that, because we just believe in the material world, perhaps, because we don't have a connection to an invisible world. Like, I think of going to church, and I've never been a religious person, but I think there's something cool. When I have gone to church for other friends or something, what I like about it is it's a moment you take out of your week where you think about something besides your daily life. And I think that's what Morbid and Ebony offered. And we never said that, but secretly, behind the scenes, when the museum opened in particular and I watched people on the streets, I would say, you know, we're kind of like a church more than a museum, or maybe all museums are like churches.
Well,
it's like a place where you can step outside commerce and like experience transcendent, sublime things and experience a physical and physiological and psychological kind of state of exaltation, you know? And I think there's something, unless you're speaking it out, like we are, we're speakers, right? Which is why we're doing this work. But unless you're speaking it or are lucky enough to have it in your family or in your community, how do you even know there's out there? How do you know there's something that can give meaning, you know?
Yeah, that's so fascinating. We had an experience to go to Rome and Lecce and Naples, but we were in Rome and we got a chance to go up the Spanish Steps and go to this huge church, which I did end up lighting some candles at. And, you know, I'm not a religious person. Of course, I had to pay like €5 to pray. So there's always a little capitalism tied into the church as well. But when you do walk in there, you do get that sort of feeling of like, wow, you're in a space that you're allowed to, you know, maybe think in a more spiritual way. When it comes to the Morbid Anatomy Museum, what was the intention, or what did you want to instill in people when they walked through the doors? What mood did you want to put them in?
That's a great question. And we thought a lot about that. You know, my feeling was death, the word death and the idea of death in our culture is so like heavy and sad and dirty. And I wanted it to be a place that was beautiful and uplifting. And I wanted that to be a frame for the object you saw within that kind of made you feel, oh, I thought of death blank, but now I think blank. You know, that's kind of what the experience I wanted. And the blanks, I didn't care. I just wanted to help transform people's ideas of this. Again, I would say, just, you know, going back to the occult, this great mystery. You know, like what I find so fascinating about death as well is like, it is probably the defining mystery of being human. Like we have science, we have all of these things that we've done. We've conquered diseases. We've, you know, discovered germs under microscopes. But neither have we defeated death, nor have we come to understand it. We do right. not know what happens to us after we die. Isn't it fascinating? And we walk around as if there isn't this great mystery that will happen to all of us.
Right.
And when you think about that, it changes. I think it just changes how we think about our lives on Earth, too. And going back to what one of you was saying about capitalism earlier, I kind of think contemplating death is anti-capitalistic because... Like, if you, the reason I do my project, and hearing what you guys said, too, you're afraid of death. Part of why we do what we do is I have a very healthy fear of death, say, or a realization that I could die at any moment. And because of that, I don't sit around, I don't have a 9-to-5 job, I don't have a lot of money, I don't have a Mercedes-Benz, you know, I don't live large, but I live the life I want to live based on my values. And I think that's what contemplation of death actually provides and has historically provided people. Is a way to keep it in perspective, you know? Like, if my time on Earth is limited, and especially now when we don't believe in an afterlife, then I'd better, for God's sakes, I'd better do exactly what I want now, because I could die tomorrow, or I could get cancer tomorrow, as friends of mine have, you know? Or talking to my dad, who's like, now has so many aches and pains, he doesn't want to travel much anymore. It's like, what we have now is what we have now, and there's no guarantee we're going to have it in the future.
Exactly. I think that's exactly it. And I also like about walking into the Morbid Anatomy Museum is that it's very similar to the Mutter Museum, or when I recently just went to an exhibit of John Wayne Gacy's artwork in L.A., and there's something about the vibrations, not to get too like...
sucking on the bong about it, but I definitely
that was a bong. That was not that was a bong sound. That
I've
was
heard
the most disgusting.
High school. I love that. Okay.
All right. Well,
but there's something about going there. You walk into a room and you're 2 feet from bones that were in a person. They were like in like that is a thing. You look at this was what you were seeing, a picture of a dead person that was dead and it was propped up like this. So and there's something about it. There's a trapped energy to it that is pretty remarkable. And I think it's important for people to be around because they don't get to see shit like this. They don't really go about their day because they are not Ed Gein. You know what I mean? They didn't spend their lives collecting body parts in their home. But if they did, they'd know.
Yeah, and Ed Gein, it turns out all he had to do was open up a museum and he would have been like just a businessman. not just
there
a grave robber.
Everything would have been solved.
Let's see. I mean, Henry, do you have any more questions? I feel like this has been so amazing.
This is much deeper than we normally go.
Much deeper.
Much which I deeper. Like.
No, absolutely.
It's fun.
And a conversation that has to be had because I completely agree with both of you. Death is one of those that every morning you wake up and you're like, might as well check off something I wanted to do with my life because you're never guaranteed the next day. So that's one of the great reminders of the museum.
Well, thank you. And I hope you guys will come to our new space. Come and check it out. It's wonderful. And it's a Greenwood Cemetery, which is one of the most beautiful cemeteries in New York. Founded 1838. It was like a huge tourist attraction in the 19th century. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Where is it at? Where in New York?
Yeah, it's basically just south of Park Slope. And it was, like I said, it was founded in 1838. After when in Niagara Falls, it was the biggest tourist attraction in New York City for a while. Isn't that fascinating?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, let's talk about changing attitudes about death, right? It was seen as a beautiful sculpture garden. And it's got, you know, landscaped hills and these incredible trees and birds. And we were, so basically Harry Weil and Lisa Alpert very kindly offered us this beautiful 1870s former rest house. It's like a mini Gothic mansion. And downstairs, it's like a parlor, which is what our exhibit space is. And then upstairs is this like timbered Adirondack style attic, which is the library. People can come up, they can spend all day, look at books. You guys should come up, check it out. I think you'll like it.
I love it.
Have you ever been to the Necropolis in Glasgow?
Yes, I have.
I remember it was Marcus and I, we went when we were doing our UK tour, and I've never seen like a celebration or the idea of like a city for the dead, which was absolutely incredible, except Marcus was very hungover and he had to leave and he had to go throw up outside of the parking lot. And then we went back in and we had a lovely, very respectful time looking at that. But it's like, that's what I want, man. I want a tomb.
I know. They're so beautiful. There's also a place, I don't know if you guys have been to Columbarium in San Francisco. Have you heard of that?
Mm-mm.
No. So it's very cool. It was also found in the 19th century, but it's basically people are given these little, maybe like 3-foot by 2-foot windowed spaces they can like put all these objects in, and then have a plaque for the dead, and then the ashes are kept in there as well. So it's kind of like going through a museum of how people are trying to represent their dead relatives. And it's actually a very beautiful form of memorialization. It's very, I predict it will become more popular because it's like, you totally get a sense of the person. It's not like a gravestone, which is this kind of monumental, you know, say bland, but it's right. Pretty, you know, it doesn't represent so much the individual, but seeing someone's like birthday cards and their saints that they like and, you know, whatever, it's just, I think it's really a really fascinating way to memorialize.
I love it. All right. Joanne Ebenstein, everyone. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Live from your grave.
What a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, that was awesome, man. And so check out, make sure to go to her blog, the Morbid, what is it, what's the?
Morbidanatomymuseum.org.
Check that out. And I'm definitely going to try to get out there to their most recent place and check it out before it goes away. But yeah, dude, that was great.
That was awesome. What a very cool, it just always makes you want to go back to like collecting creepy shit in the house again, because it's so much fun. But like, our house is already so evil looking, and Natalie's like, your mom's going to come at some point.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We have to like not have too many pentagrams. Like,
well, you're still not, you're not on the level yet of Marcus, because Marcus has all the bones. And I feel like bones is really where it gets like extra creepy.
That's where it's quite a bit. And they take upkeep.
Yes, they do.
And he's not doing the upkeep.
Oh, wow. I'm not going to let him know about that diss. That's, you got him. You got him.
Got him again, yeah.
Oh, my God. All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much. And again, thank you so much for giving to our Patreon. You guys really made this whole thing possible. I'm going to do a solid hail yourselves. And a Magustalations.
Hail Satan. Thank you for your money.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much. And we will be back with an interview very, very soon.
Brr!